Danny the Kitman. Danny the Kitman. We went up to Inverness with this. Maxim was the as a manager, and we stayed a couple of nights. And Danny the Kitman and a few other sort of background staff and stuff like that went out, took Maxim out. And I think they got him drinking Mad Dog 2020, just making it as if it was like a local drink. And you want to have seen the stadium the next morning. We had a game, we were playing Ross County the next day, and Maximo could hardly keep his eyes open. He was just like a burst ball, you know, it was just like almost hysterical.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the CSI Football Podcast, where we embark on a forensic delve into a particular season of football, usually with a tartan tint. I'm your host, Ian Stephen. And for today's episode, we meet a man who was worth a ton, was whiter than white, made a U-turn before terrorising the opposition, ultimately found his way into the hearts of Lions. It's Derek Lilly. Derek, how are you?
I'm good, Ian. Yeah, no, I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Took me about half an hour to write that intro.
Good effort.
So let's start at the beginning. Where were you born and brought up, and who were your team as a youngster?
So yeah, so born in Paisley. Brought up in Erskine, mum and dad moved down to Erskine, 50 odd years ago now, and I was born 1974. Grew up locally, and my team as a kid was Rangers. Yeah, we were all Rangers. My mum and dad were from Glasgow. My brother was into Rangers, and I just sort of tagged along and ended up sort of following Rangers. I wouldn't say I'm not a diehard fan of it, but yeah, that was the team.
So how did you start making the move into football? What was your youth football journey?
Like, Erskine was a new town, but like come on, all these types of places, just loads of people sort of all live locally. And great group of guys all my age, and we all love football. So played through the school team, and then Erskine Boys Club was quite a good boys club. And that was my first sort of step into football. As a goalkeeper, I might add, when I was 8 years of age. So, yeah, that's when I first took my step. And then I soon realised that actually goalkeeper wasn't for me. And I was really quick at running. I ended up playing as a winger and all this kind of stuff. And it just sort of developed and going. Never really touched any sort of senior football until probably 15, 16. But by that time, I'd moved from Erskine Boys Club to Everton Boys Club. The reason being was, I thought, you know, there was... Somebody contacted me and said, oh, we do get a lot of scouts coming in our game. And I thought, you know what, I'll try a different team. You know, and they were playing a sort of different league. One was the West Coast of Scotland, one was the Glasgow. So we're playing in different leagues. So I thought, give it a bash. And yeah, and I ended up getting a few trials. I played in Everton Boys Club. But I had actually, there was no association with Everton, the team. We did actually go down and play a game against Everton. And in the back of that, I ended up doing some training with Everton during the sort of school holidays, Easter holidays. Unfortunately, nothing materialised, you know, just thanks but no thanks. And then I'd went sort of trials at Clyde Bank, you know, Louisville, no longer with us in senior football. Dunfermline, came with Celtic. So just playing away. It was always kind of just trial here, trial there. And then it wasn't until I was 17, I was working in Babcock, so I was an apprentice welder. And just got a phone call out of the blue saying, my Everton football manager at the time was saying, look, Rangers, Morton want to give you a trial game, and they're playing Rangers in it's a closed door game down at Capel, like an afternoon, you take time off work. And yeah, played a game, get beat 5-1, scored a goal, got asked to go and play a friendly against Airdrie, scored a couple of goals, and that sort of set me off from my sort of steps into sort of senior football.
Was it Alan McGraw that signed you with Morton?
It was, yeah, Mr. McGraw, the man, the myth, the legend.
For people that don't know, I mean, he was at Morton for a good 10 years as manager. One of the quite famous as a footballer that suffered badly with injuries in later life, coming back to haunt him. What was he like to deal with for you being a kind of wide-eyed youngster?
Do you know, it was great because, unbeknown to me, Morton had a good reputation of having young players and bleeding young players at the team. So the manager had a great mindset and giving young players a chance. And honestly, Ian, it was the most simple instructions, and it was, for me as a young player, it was great. It was just a case of, look, son, just you go out, run fast and score goals. I mean, that's when I was just starting off, it was as simple as that. And, you know, he couldn't be a nicer guy, you know. he was so pleasant. You know, he was all chatty in his office, talking. He just made you feel so welcoming. And because there was quite a few younger players in the team, I think it sort of helped you settle in. And funny, you mentioned about, you know, his career, and I didn't appreciate it at the time, but, you know, I think he's, one season he scored over about 50 goals, you know, back in his heyday, and then he suffered horrendous injuries, and he got these cortisone injections, which basically left him with no knees. And that was, because back then, when you got an injury, you either played or you didn't. It was as simple as that. There was no benches, or you had to keep playing. And he's about 30 odd injections in one of his knees, and they've ended up with no knee. So he was, you could see that, you know, he loved football. He was good about with walking sticks. He was a character, didn't take any rubbish off with anybody. You knew you stood with him, but, you know, everybody respected him. He was well thought in the game.
You know how cruel footballers can be. Did anybody try and hide his walking sticks?
Nobody, I wouldn't say anybody tried to hide them, because, I mean, he relied on them so much. You know, he had two walking sticks, so there was no, he couldn't physically move without his walking sticks. But one of the funniest things I did ever see from was we're playing Clyde at Broadwood. It was Broadwood at times relatively new. I think that was full time of 21 or something. And a big, massive male hampers get brought in the dressing room, and they get brought in, and all the kits in them, and everybody's getting ready. But those kits are always lying open, because you're always, people get in and out and get whatever they need to get out of them, physio stuff and all that. And he was standing next to him, and his leg had a tendency to lock. No one noticed, it would just lock, and he would generally fall over and bang his head or something. This occasion he fell and went right in the hamper. And the boys all started laughing. You know, he took it good, and Alan Mahood, who was sitting next to me, says to him, "Gaffer, I'm going to give us a tie up out of the box, please." So it was just he gave Bill the, you know, and he took it all on his side, but it was a funny moment.
I had a lot of faith in you, because you were really young when you made your debut, were you not?
I was 17, so yeah, I literally had I had these two trial games against Rangers and then Airdrie, scored a few goals, got asked in the pre-season. Signed it, I played a junior team, it was like Irvine Vicks or something, Irvine Victoria, scored a goal, and then I came in and I signed a part-time deal. And that was been the summer of 1991. And it was, just over 17. And within a matter of what seemed like months, I was put in with the first team, and I made my debut against Partick Thistle at Burhill. And I was only 17. And it was like, welcome to senior football. And there was a big guy, Willie Jameson, at the back. Never forget it. It must have been in his 30s. And went up from my header, first header in the game, and get an almighty thump in the side of my head and burst my ear open. So it was like, welcome to senior football.
Well, it was a really kind of interesting squad that you had at Morton as well, because you'd guys like Derek McInnes, David Hopkins, and Rowan Alexander were in that squad when you were breaking through.
With such a talented team. It was, when I first joined, I was only part-time. And yeah, see, Derek McInnes was in there. Alan Mahood had left. The big David Hopkins was in there. Yeah. Rowan, experienced pro, was there. And there was a few other younger guys. Alex Mathig had signed from Celtic. Another young player. So those guys were sort of playing week in, week out. And at that time, when I was there, David Hopkins had sold to Chelsea for, you know, 350 grand. And Alex Mathig went to Newcastle. So there was this sort of, and it was always scouts coming to the game. There was always young players getting a chance. And then I was sort of 20, 21, and I went full time. I finished my apprenticeship, and I says to Alan McGraw, "Can I come in time?" He says, "Yeah, and you come." I thought, it's kind of now or never, let's give it a go. But that time, you know, when Alan Mahood was a young player, he'd come back from Nottingham Forest, who they sold. With the two Finnish players, Janne Lindberg and Marco Rajamäki. Warren Hawke signed from Berwick. You know, we just, at that time, with a bunch of young guys, you know, we'd come through that sort of experience. But Rowan was still there as well in the background as an experienced player. So, but the team transformed between sort of, you know, 94, 95, into about 90, 96, 97. This sort of, we'd went more full time, and there was more younger players, and the older players like Rowan, and that ended up leaving. And It was such a talented sport.
I've had quite a few expeditions to Capilo as a journalist, a couple as a fan, and I absolutely adore the place. What's your experience of playing at Capilo as a player?
Well, it's got a weird thing about it. Even now, when I was there a few weeks ago, doing some stuff with BBC, and I still want to walk. I mean, if you walk in the main stand, you come in, you go underneath, and you can actually go down the main door in the dressing room. It's all mahogany tunnel, and it just sort of grabs you. It feels as if you're transported back in time, and it's just such a special place for me. Scored my first goal against Meadowbank there. The fans were always pretty good with me, even although when I was part-time, young player, they always supported me. And then the years we went full-time, the year I went full-time from 94 onwards, we won the second division. The next season, we nearly got back-to-back promotions. We just fell short. We drew with Dundee United. There was a year, it was a playoff. I think Dunfermline had won the league for St Johnstone, and we were fighting there with Dundee United to finish second. It was like 12,000 at a game. It was just real magical moments, and played Aberdeen in the cup there, and I was top goal scorer for a few seasons as well. So just crowd was right top of you, just to rock around, it was really tight. Just loved everything about it, I never knew anything different really, but even sometimes the winter the pitch could be really heavy, but all these things were an advantage to us, and just such a nice small family club, good group of players. Fans, we were on a bit of an upward trajectory in terms of doing well and winning the league, and so the crowds were really good, so that it was just such a great period in time in my life in terms of professional football.
Well, the 96-97 season in particular, Morton, was exceptional for you. You went on a goal-scoring run, you had 20 goals, you scored in 14 out of 15 games, and you ultimately came to the attention of George Graham in Leeds. You were signed just before deadline day in March for £500,000. That's £950,000 in today's money, adjusted for inflation. You're the only person that wants inflation to rise, so you can say to people, I was worth a million.
Players, it's quite a story.
So how did the move to Leeds come about? Because Leeds were still absolutely massive at that time.
Yeah, but very strange set bet. So, like I said just now, you get a transfer windows and it opens up for 1 month at a time. Back then in my day, which a long time ago now, but the way the transfer window, you could sign anybody throughout the season, but actually it was the last 5 or 6 weeks of the season it shut, so that you couldn't sign players like in the second last game and stuff like that. There was always about 5 or 6 games to go. It was in March, and so this deadline was approaching, and out of the blue, got a phone call from the manager. Dundee United were interested. They gave a fee, £300,000. You got to go and speak to him. It was Tommy McLean. Right, okay, me and my agent, Jim MacArthur, up to Dundee United. I talked to them. Everything seemed okay. Agreed a deal. I think there was a player, Sandy Robertson, that Dundee United were hoping would go to Morton, but I don't think he wanted to go. So I had my talks. Agreed the package, that kind of stuff, agreed terms. But the old chairman of Morton at that time, no mobile phones, it was all done on a fax machine. They've got to physically release you. They've got to sign documents to release you. And he never done that. So Saturday came, again, bizarrely, playing at Fir Hill. I think it might have been Clyde. I don't know, somebody was ground sharing with them. I'm not sure if it was this word. But turned up at Fir Hill. Nobody's expecting me to show up. I show up. Boys are all a bit, what are you doing here? Well, going to play. It's not been finalised yet. Playing the Saturday, scored 2 goals. Unbeknown to me, the chairman knew that Leeds and Crystal Palace were coming to watch me on the Saturday, so that's why he never released me. So after the game, it was the next day, the Sunday, phone call, Crystal Palace had bid £500,000. You need to go down and speak to Crystal Palace. Me and my agent jump on a flight down to London. In the middle of sort of talks with Crystal Palace, my agent was getting notifications from Leeds, so to speak, that were interested in speaking to their scout. And then Leeds put a bid in while I was going through talks with Crystal Palace. So all kind of happened about 4 or 5 days. It was a bit mad, that kind of transfer window deadline day scenario. And yeah, ended up into London, middle of central London, met up with George Graham, deal got agreed. And that was it. Yeah. And it was, and also didn't realize at the time, but I was part of another deal that was totally unbeknown to me as well, that my agent represented Davy Robertson, the Rangers, and Davy signed in the summer, as well as signing me and my agent, right? George Graham was speaking to my agent about Davy Robertson. So it was quite a strange set of affairs. But yeah, I just looked at it. So, you know, Leeds is the biggest team. They're in the Premier League. Let's go there. So let's start there first. And if it goes well, great. If it doesn't, you know, it can fall down the leagues as I go along, you know, and just, but because it was the biggest team, Premier League team, I couldn't say no.
It was a pretty kind of stacked squad that you joined as well. Alfie Haaland was there. I think his son's playing football nowadays. I think I heard something about that. Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank was there. Harry Kewell. The list goes on and on and on with the talent. You also had Davy Hopkins was there, and you also had Davy Robertson, as you said, to help you settle in. Did you go down kind of, as we would say in Scotland, a bit gallus, thinking this would be easy? Or did you go down with your kind of eyes wide open at the kind of the step up that you'd taken?
Oh, it was very, very much, you know, eyes wide open, you know, just knew. So it was a real, talking about some of the players, when I first signed there was you had Ian Rush, Tony DeNiro, Thomas Brolin, Tony Yeboah, Carlton Palmer. So there was this kind of older group of players that George Graham was trying to get out of the club, and then, you know, the younger players were coming through, and new signings, Davy Hopkins, Davy Robertson, Alfie signed, Jimmy signed, there were seven of us. They signed with a French guy, Pierre signed, so that real sort of transition. But when I just looked at some of the names, just looked at some of the faces that I'm used to training every month, I had to pinch myself. Just thinking, you know, and you're playing alongside him in training, and it was playing with him in reserve games. It was very much, you know, I was a fit guy, and you know, I know I'd a lot to learn in football, but this was a whole new level, and I had to really step my game up. Then, you know, the first 6 months, just to really get to that sort of level where I could compete on a regular basis with these guys. I mean, it was physically demanding, you know, challenging. So yeah, very much I wasn't expecting just to go in there and get on with it. It was a case I'm going to have to really, if I'm going to be successful, I'm going to have to work my backside off.
What was George Graham like? Because he presented an image of a man that was always impeccably dressed, attention to detail, but very strict.
He was very firm. He was very hands-on with coaching. He was always in the training field every day, you know, and it was very much, you know, I mean, a lot of it was done shape. Didn't mean it was a lot of, during the day, you know, working on shape formations. You could, as a young player, you obviously knew reputation at Arsenal had with that sort of back four. And you could see he was instilling that in Leeds in terms of the back four, the goalkeeper. So the days during training where the back four would go away and work with George Graham, the manager, and David O'Leary would take the forwards and the midfielders for shooting. So it was very, very meticulous, you know, turning up before games, and obviously the level of detail now is incredible. Back then it was always a flip chart, no formations, who's doing what, you know, a bit of tactics, you know, players, you know, he was very, you know, if a team had a real, in terms of a player like so. Steve McManaman at Liverpool, because I remember, you know, there'd be somebody would put on him, do a Van Marking job. You know, he was very, very meticulous, and, you know, they really sort of transformed Leeds and how they were going, because it was only a couple of years after Leeds had won the actual with the whole first division, and they were struggling a wee bit. He'd come in and got it to European football to really stabilise the club, brought in fresh blood, and everybody was so keen. So, you know, team full of energy. I think that's how well, you know, fresh legs coming into the team. But he was very, very, I mean, immaculately dressed. I don't think I ever seen any. Every now and again, he'd be trying to look, and it was always Armani this and Armani that. It was all the best of gear, immaculate, not a hair out of place. And he was a nice guy, very, very played, very professional, very nice guy. You know, probably sometimes as a young player as well, he'd maybe feel a wee bit intimidated by him. But you know, it was good experience.
And did you become an integral part of the squad by being there to interpret for Davy Robertson?
Davy was my roommate. And Davy was a bit of a quiet man. But bizarrely, he was quite quiet back then. But Davy was always funny. You know, he just, he, he was, just get started. It was the last man in the morning, first black guy in our first away home with night and stuff like that. It was like, they were just naturally fit. And he's funny, you see documentaries, David Sweller, Banshee, and all these different, you know, when he was out up in the Kashmir. But by then, David was quite a quiet, quite a subdued guy. I mean, but, you know, it was nice when you got to know him and speak to him. Actually, I used to get the stories out of Rangers. I was intrigued with the sort of Rangers side of things. And he says, look, you think Leeds is a big club? He says, Rangers is a monstrous club compared to Leeds, you know. So it was really nice to try and pick his brains. But no, he I say, the room wheeled for a good while. Between me, him, and Hoppy, you know, there was and Eddie Graves. There was always a lot of Scots there, so with a good laugh.
You don't have a kind of contact to try and get in touch with the grey grandchild that's now playing for Leeds to try and get him to play for Scotland because he's committed for England. Is it Archie?
Yeah. Gray. Yeah, I seen the name popping up, and so there was all that Eddie Gray being the coach. And Eddie's brother was Frank Gray, and Frank Gray's son was Andy Gray, who Andy was a young player that came through Leeds, and Andy went on to play for Sheffield United and stuff like that. And I think it's his son. So it's Eddie's nephew's son. And I seen that, and because I could see him, and I thought, well, he looks like his dad Andy, tall and quite thin, although he's young, but No, I've not got any contact details, unfortunately, but he looks a right good player.
If you've got your granddad, your great uncle, and your dad that have all been capped by Scotland, how can you represent England? He must his mother's side of the family must be really persuasive.
I don't know what happened there because I'm sure Andy Gray, who the young boy was, Andy was maybe a couple of years younger than me. I'm sure he played for Scotland, especially. Yeah, I'm sure he must have got a few caps because he done. Andy did a good career, and Eddie was a legend. He's him and Eddie Frank were legends, and yeah, that's an interesting one. I didn't realize he played for England. Might change his tune, but when he gets to the full squad, if he doesn't get a sniff of it.
Aye, let's hope. Fingers crossed. But when you scored your first league goal for Leeds, it was in pretty dramatic circumstances against Barnsley. Do you want to talk us through it? Because that must have been a memorable first goal.
It was. I mean, I had a couple of near misses. I'd scored against Forest, was given offside. I scored against Middlesbrough, offside. You know, and I was playing. I was always in the fringes of the first team. So I was in it. Always travelled with the first team. I was in the squad on the bench, but during the week I'd play reserves. And I was really starting to find my feet. So signing the March, and this was probably coming up to November, and I'd really found my feet. Bought a house, settled in. Scoring week in, week out of the reserves, you know, you just know your things are starting to click. And turned up at Oakwell, November time, absolutely pissing it down with rain. And she's really heavy. And I think before you know it, we're 2-0 down. You're in the first half, 2-0 down, you know, and I'm on the bench and it's just a horrible day. And you know, there's like kind of catalogue of errors. And just you think this is not turning out good. But then, Alfie Haaland scored just before half time and 2-1. And so you're thinking, right, well, we're back in the game. Second half starts on the bench, jumping at the bit. You know, we're jumping at the bit every week to go on. And then I think it was Lee Boyle. I got pulled off maybe 20 minutes ago and came on. So it was myself, Rod Wallace, Jimmy Hasselbank was up front. So we're having a bit of a go. And Nigel Larton kicked a ball at a huge clearance. And I'm up and challenged with a big centre half. Two of us completely missed the ball, but bounced through and Rod stuck it away. Two Leeds were in it. And we're shooting towards the end where all Leeds fans are. There's no colours, they're just soaked, totally soaked. And then there's a bit of sort of passage of play. And I've looked to the back, you see the videos back. Ball's kind of half stopping in the mud a wee bit, you know. There is grass on the pitch, really heavy. And the ball got put out wide, and then it was Rod Wallace ran on it and just whipped it in. And I could sort of see it. I was coming at the back post. Just nicked in front of the defender. Is it good strikers to do? You know, get in front of the ball, in front of your defender, and just flicked over the goalie. And you know, it was my one and only goal at Leeds, and it was a winner. And the Leeds fans were that. And then you look at the old pitches; the fans are on the pitch, though, they're all piling in. You know, because they're a bit of a local derby. But yeah, it was great. For me, I walked off the pitch 1-3-2. I felt as if I was 10 foot tall. I can remember driving home. The bus dropped us off at Ellen Road. I was driving back to my house, a 20-minute drive. I was driving through a road of Leeds and just minding my own business, you know. And there's a few cars passing, slowing down and tooting the horn and all that, and giving it all waving. So it was a kind of special moment.
Well, you ended up moving to Hearts on loan in 1998. Was that instigated by you wanting to get more games under your belt?
Yeah, wasn't really playing. I was on the fringes. You can see that things aren't quite panning out, you know. They were signing players as well. So you want to play. And Matt, at the time, you think, right, Joe, well, there was a chance to go to Hearts. And I thought, right, good, go up there, have a good time, you know, enjoy the football. Jim Jeffries, Hearts were struggling a wee bit that season. I knew a few of the boys. Jim Hamill was there, a few other boys that I knew. I thought, right, we'll go in and give that bash. So I was quite looking forward to it. It did come about quite quickly. I think it was near sort of December time, and just up quite quickly, not in the green. And then it was maybe a 3-month loan deal, and it just sort of, I managed to score a goal. I think I did score a goal. I think it was against Dundee. I may have been in my debut, actually. Big David Weir got sent off. I think I scored and we got beat. I was staying at the hotel, and for the time I was there, I was staying at the hotel at the Post House, which I think is a holiday now, right at the zoo. And just nothing went right. Like, I came home from training one day. There was a jacket we'd stolen out of my room. Came home from training another day, and my wife was there, you know, with two kids. And there's a woman in reception holding my daughter, and I'm thinking, what's going on here? And she went, oh, your wife's away to hospital, your son's well, and supply his lip open. And then it was another week, I got my wallet stolen at the training ground. And you're just thinking, and then it was another week I was playing at the horrendous, we're playing Motherwell, had a horrendous throat infection, probably shouldn't even be playing. And it was just one of these, it was a week after week, there was something happening. I thought, I'm just not meant to be here. One of the weeks I was going to training, got blowing my tire, and thinking, what's going on? And so last place of 6 weeks, and they terminated the loan deal, and now I'm back, and I was so happy to get back. I just thought I just wasn't meant to be. So came about really quickly. I was a bit gutted, so I was hoping, you know, I was hoping we got there, do well, you know, and maybe try and secure a permanent deal and come back up the road. I was a bit gutted it never worked out, but when I'm back to Leeds, and it was just one of these periods of time in your life, just like I was never meant to be. Just all these things happened that was just a bit of a nightmare.
Well, something that perhaps was meant to be, you were loaned out to Bury. You scored your first goal against Oxford United. Your contract was up with Leeds, and then Oxford United remembered that goal you scored against them, and in August 99, you became a U. And a bit of a kind of manager merry-go-round in that season with like Malcolm Shorten, Mickey Lewis, Dennis Smith in charge, and Oxford finished one place above the drop zone in that season.
That was a tough season. Again, coming to the end of the season, was needing to move and just needing to play games. And it was Malcolm Shorten. And bizarrely, Malcolm Shorten, I'd played against him about 7 or 8 years before that. I was a young boy, 17 at Morton, and he was at Air United, centre half. I didn't even realise that. And I'd scored against Oxford and Axel. I think I played a part in them game. Did they get relegated? I think they may get relegated that year. And then a year after I signed for them. So Malcolm Shorten came in, you're going to be my number one striker. You're thinking, happy days, great, I'm going to be playing, you know, why you come in? And, you know, we'd signed Peter Fear, came in from Wimbledon. A few other boys, Paul Tapes, Birmingham, you know, big Kevin Francis, don't even remember him, big massive, big centre forward from Birmingham. He was mad, big kid. Loads of injuries, you know, weird, but Big Kevin. So Big Kevin's like 6'5", 6'6", you know, bam, like a big shit house, huge. And he'd loads of bad injuries. You looked at one of his legs was like normal, quite a muscular leg. The other one was like a wee stick thin leg because he had so many injuries, and he used to limp all the time. But the big man could still score for throw-ins and corners and all that kind of stuff. But it just never really struggled to get off the ground. Bad start to the season, in terms of, you know, losing games. Next thing you know, Malcolm Shorten gets sacked. Me and Mickey Lewis steps up. You know, again, I think we pick up a wee bit, form drops off, and then, you know, he goes, and then I think there was a Mike Ford as well, stepped in for a wee bit before Dennis came in. And it wasn't until Dennis Smith came in towards the end of the season that, you know, I think we really sort of started to get it together. You know, we'd been in that sort of final season. And I never really featured that much at the beginning when Dennis came in and managed to fight my way back into the team. But we pulled out some big results and that kept us up. So it was a tough season. And, you know, if you get through three, four lines, as you say, the merry-go-round, it's, you never quite know if your face is going to fit. So you're just fighting. So I felt like the whole season we just fighting, got to the end of the season. Well, we're just delighted that we'd stayed up. But yeah, Dennis was I don't know if Dennis is still with us. I think, I don't know if he passed away, but he was a nice, he reminded me a bit of Alex Smith, really nice, genuine guy, knew loads about, you know, very, very experienced, just an element of calmness in terms of probably what we needed, you know, just to sort of help get you over the line and let people relax and try and play football when you're in a dog fight at the bottom of the league. So yeah, I've got fond memories of Dennis. I just think he was just a good coach. That he was the right person to come in at the right time and got us over the line.
Well, you mentioned Alex Smith, and you were snapped up by Dundee United, turn of the century. He scored in your debut against Rangers. He ended up as top scorer for United, and netting again against Rangers. You clearly got something against them. But the second half of that season was quite tight. United were trying to fight clear of relegation, but you also made the semi-finals of the Cup that year.
Yeah, it was. But there was an offset. Circumstances changed at Oxford and Dundee United went to me, looked at the situation, spoke to them, and, you know, with no hesitation about signing. Obviously wanted to come back up the road, but I thought Alex Smith had stepped in, great guy. He was a client manager when I was at Morton, so he remembered me, and I just had to look at the team. You know, they'd signed Jim Loughlin, Jamie Fulton had signed, Charlie Miller had signed, I'd signed. So there was a lot of foreign players at Dundee United, but somehow bringing a bit of Scottish blood back in. And Jim Hanwell was there. There was a lot of guys that I knew, and it just felt the right thing and came in and just said, scored my debut. And I think our form the second half of the season, I think if you'd sort of mirrored that first half, we'd have been comfortably mid-table, maybe above. But in a dogfight with St Mirren, I think we were 3-4 points behind St Mirren at one point. And they managed to claw them back in. Got some, I think we beat them 4-0 at Tannadice one day and one of the games. And then we got into the second last game of the season. And we played St Johnson at McDermott Park. And as long as we won that day, then we knew we'd be safe, albeit with another game against Aberdeen, which we didn't really want to go to the last game of the season against Aberdeen at the Todd. You know, we go in there, played St Johnson, you know, I can't remember who St Mirren were playing. I think, were they playing? I'm not sure if it was Hibs or something they were playing. And we were 2-0 down at half-time. Charlie missed a penalty. We were 2-0 down. It's like, you know, wheels are falling off. But when I hit me up, second half starts, and Paul Hartley gets sent off for a second book of offence, called Wee Charlie. And then next thing you know, Wee Charlie makes it 2-1. Craig Easton, he makes it 2-each. In the dying seconds, you know, we're down at Park. I mean, it's a nice wee modern stand, but a ground, but I think it was Dundee United fans went to see the stands. It was good to see 4,000, at least Dundee United fans. So when I scored the third goal, 10, 15 minutes to go, it was literally a pitch invasion. It was chaos, you know, and it was such a memorable moment, you know, scored to be. I think when you score goals like that, you know, you can look back and you think, wow, you know, you've kind of left your statement, you know, certain goals that people can remember you for, and that was definitely one of them. So, and the irony is, my dad was at that game with my son, and he left at half-time because the abuse that we were getting as a team. The fans were going mad, and my dad says, I couldn't listen to any more, so he left. It wasn't the time he drove home again, he'd realised we'd actually won the game, so he just had enough.
I hope he disagreed with the abuse. I hope he didn't leave because he found himself agreeing and he felt shame.
I think my dad's a bit of a hothead, and he's my dad's not, if he wants to voice opinion, he's no shy in doing that, that's for sure. And I think it was either that, he either walked away or he was going to end up getting a scrap with something. So I think he just decided, let's just get out of here. And he took my... Derek, my son, was about 5 at the time. He took him with him. So he says, the abuse was incredible. Fastballed that 45 minutes and everybody's elated. It was bizarre.
It's kind of It's a kind of weird situation. Like, it's maybe the only industry where it's accepted that customers are allowed to abuse effectively the employees of an establishment, and it's seen as being loyal or patriotic. It's a weird kind of dichotomy with football. But talking about
that is, do you know, I do draw lazy in that. I've also been away from football now, and I've worked big corporate organisations, you know, and it's weird because there's something about football as well. People feel as if they can say empty, you just got to take it, you know, it comes with the territory. But I always think about that on the playing side of it. People say to me, like, you know, they sort of ask you, talk about questions and talk about pressure, and I'll say, well, I'll tell you what, I say, you know, whatever industry you work in, I say, see if you're to be surrounded by 10 or 15,000 people abusing you, abusing your family, you know, singing songs about you. I says, how well do you think you could cope with doing your job? Irrespective of what it is, do you think you could cope with it? And they go, and they look at you as if you're daft. They think, well, that's the environment I'm working on. That's what it's like. You know, you've just got to zone that out. It's a weird world to be in, that's for sure.
I always like it when you're nice to a footballer when they're not expecting it, and they're chuffed like, I don't want to say like children, that's not very fair, but you know, it's a kind of an innocence about them, because Stephen Gartman, the Aberdeen centre-half, was at Livy a couple of weeks ago, and he's walked past me, and I gave him a fist bump, and he looked totally chuffed that somebody had been nice to him. Just a random stranger was nice. He'd not experienced it, so.
They're probably, you know, most of their actions that, apart from a bench and all that kind of stuff, but most of the interactions for a lot of players will be negative. You know, it's just people having a pop at you or saying whatever. And, you know, I go and watch football games now and I look at people, I'm like, why do you even come here? Do you actually enjoy it? Because when they step in, the minute they leave, there's just nothing but shout at players and abuse them. It's like bizarre.
Yeah. You're going to have to explain to us what it was like playing with Charlie Miller for that length of time, because Charlie is certainly one of the more enigmatic players that played in Scottish football.
Charlie was brilliant. I remember Charlie. I had a little spell training with Rangers when I was about 14 or 15. And I remember Charlie was a young man coming through. So Charlie remembered me, and I remember him. So when I joined the Dundee United, oh yeah, come up and stay at mine and all that. And I knew Charlie liked a drink. You're thinking, oh, here we go. And, I think it was like a Thursday night. His wife Caroline was making a bite to eat, and I'm staying with him up in Dundee. And he's like, you want a drink? I'm like, what are you wanting this? I didn't stumble. No, just a Diet Coke. So I can gel it. You know, it's a gel it's a little Thursday night. You know, just usual, but a bite of tea, drink 3 or 4 cans of beer. And that was just him, you know, and he was just a cat. Do you know what? He couldn't meet a nicer guy. He'd give his last penny, you know. But a wee man loved a drink, loved a gamble on the horses, loved betting on stuff. And also, he terrible eyesight. Charlie had quite thick glasses, and you know, you see him in the dressing room, be sitting down and he'd have glasses on that. So I used to always say to him, do you wear contacts? And he was like, no. But Charlie would go out to the pitch, and whether he'd have drank the night before or he's been up, Charlie was the best player on the pitch nearly every day. You know, it was just incredible. You know, bearing in mind his eyesight wasn't great, but you could put him out in that pitch, left foot, right foot, and he's one of the most talented players I've ever played alongside. Do you know, it was bizarre. When I signed for Dundee United, I went, we viewed a couple of houses up in Dundee area, and I thought, right, we'll stay local and all that kind of stuff. I went and we looked at a couple of houses, and the company, the salesperson of the houses was saying, oh, you'll have a couple of neighbours that play with Dundee United. Oh, who's that? He says, well, you've got Stephen Wright. He stays over there. I went, oh, Stephen's a real nice guy. He says, Charlie would be right in front of you. I went, says to my wife, I says, we can't stay here. I says, Charlie will be at my door every day. I says, because not in a bad way, just, oh, come on in. No, it's my way. You know, just the way it was, you know, come on over and get back to you. I thought, I can't live here. I says, because I'll not get rid of him. So ended up asking me, we bought a house down in Central Mill.
Well, it was time for you to start getting some medals in your pocket. Your contract ran out with Dundee United, and Livingston were the next destination. Was there many suitors, or were Livingston the kind of prime operators in that move?
John, I actually thought I think it was 30 or 31 when that happened, and 30 I think it was. Actually, for the first time ever, and I'd worked before, but first time in terms of full-time football, I thought, don't know what's going to happen here, because I hadn't been that great at Dundee United. It's sort of mixed. Apart from the first season, spelled my goals to games ratio wasn't great, put it that way. And but Paddy Crystal came in. Jerry took over, and I could
Collins.
Was it Jerry? Jerry Collins, actually, it was Jerry Collins, yeah. And I spoke to him, and agreed a deal with him. And a lot of the money, 50% of the wages was based on appearance. And I'm going, didn't have anything else. I thought, right, it wasn't a great money. I think, well, I just need to take it. You know, that's all I've got. And then out of the blue, so I'd kind of verbally agreed it with him. I hadn't signed anything. And then out of the blue, Livingston came in. And Livingston offered me the same money, but structured differently in terms of you get more basic and less appearance. I thought, do you know what? I'll go to Livingston because, you know, it's less risky. You know what I mean? I know that in terms of there's less money getting paid in appearance. And that's kind of how it came about. So I thought it was going to Thistle. Thought, and that was fine. You know, I think they'd come up into the Premier League and they'd signed with James Grady. They had a decent side, had a bit of a go at it. But with Livingston come in, I thought, you know what? Pretty established team. A lot of good players, and I thought Livy's a place for me. It sounds good, and you know, Downing agreed to deal with them, and was just looking forward to it, cause I thought, you know, looking as well as in terms of staying in the Premier League, I thought Livy will be okay. I thought Thistle would have a tough season, and I think they did get relegated, but yeah, that was how it came about. So one option going to Thistle, but decided to go to Livingston. Probably the best decision ever made in football.
Well, you're going to have to explain the kind of the start of the season, because Marcio Maximo was the manager when you joined. He's the first Brazilian manager ever in UK football, and he only lasted 9 games, but the results weren't bad. I think it's 3 wins, 3 draws, and 3 losses, which is respectable for Livy. So what happened? Why did he leave after 9 games?
I can remember signing because Jim Leishman. It was like he was kind of heading up football, and Davy Hay was going to be the manager, or you know, he was there anyway. And then it all got announced. I'd already signed, and it all got announced. Oh, Brazilian coaches come in, so you didn't really know what to expect, and it must have been difficult for the guy. I mean, he spoke English, but not brilliant, but I mean, enough to get by with. But in any industry, in any walk of life, in any job, you know, you can get a feeling for something quite early on. You thought, this is going to be interesting, you know, in terms of his training techniques. I mean, I think he was like coach of a sort of Brazilian under 13s team or something like that. You know, really was they had never really been a senior level. I think it was something to do with Dominic Keane that got in touch with, and this is how it came about. And we were out training some days, and there was no opposition, there was no balls, it was like shadow. It's just, you know, usually when you do shadow, you've got an opposition, the young boys in, and you do a bit of shape, and that makes sense. We're just doing it ourselves, and Billy Kirkwood and Alan Preston, like, just go with it. Just try and, you know, keep switched on, go with it. So we're all trying. So it's like, oh, this is going to be that. And then the first game of the season, again, Far Howlett played. I was suspended. I had a suspension carried off from Dundee United. So I went and watched the game, and the first half they were awful. And it turns out, second half, I think they would get beat 1-0. Could have been 2 or 3. I think they drew the game 1-1. And so then folks seen the boys in the window. I was like, what happened Saturday? Says, oh, nightmare. He says, like, Davy Hay came down at half time in the dressing room and just sorted it out. So this guy, the Maximo, was obviously taking the team, but it was a total shambles. And Davy Hay had stepped in and sort of was just basically, this is how we're going to do it. This is, you know, and for the boys in my account got a result. But obviously, Davy wasn't the manager, so Davy was having to try and take a back seat, but he was still there in the background. And, you know, I think if it wasn't for the quality of the players and the minds, Alan Preston and Billy Kirkwood, Paul Heggett, the coaches, and I think between those three, if it hadn't been for those three, you know, you wouldn't have got those results, because they were like, boys, you know, just stick at it and, you know, keep at it. The boys, they all go in, the boys are a good, really good bunch of guys, so. It probably wasn't the results, you know, it was what was going on around about. You know, the guy, you could see he was missing home, he was on his own, he was in a hotel in Edinburgh, he was out of his depth, you know, you kind of felt for them. You know what I mean? It was one of these ones. You're looking at somebody, you could physically see them struggling. And, you know, and then when he left, it was like probably a relief for him as well, because it was never going to work. It just wasn't. He was out of his depths. And as I said, I think the result maybe didn't quite show that, but behind the scenes, it was a wee bit of a circus around him. And, you know, I genuinely felt for the guy. Albeit for the full time, he was there. He called me Alan. And I just ended up answering. He just kept calling me Alan. And I just answered to him. You know, and the thing was as well, you just remember. So we played. I scored. I came on as a sub and scored against Motherwell. I think we won 1-0. That was my first goal. And we went to Celtic Park. And I was on the bench. There was a few other boys that were playing in front of me. You know, so the boy Gia Poor came in from Scunthorpe, and there was a few other lads. And then I came on at Celtic Park, and we were getting beat. We ended up getting beat 5-1, but I came on and I scored. And I can always remember we were in another game, and I was on the bench. We weren't doing that well in the game, and I always remember Alan Preston saying to that back, so he says, look, you're going to have to stick him on. You know, he says, he's the only one that's scoring. You know, you're going to have to get him on, you know. You know, it was obviously, but for whatever reason, they didn't want to play me there. When he left, Davey stuck me back in the team. So it was, you know, I'll tell you a wee story. Danny the Kipman, we went up to Inverness with us. Maxim was the manager, and we stayed a couple of nights. And Danny the Kipman and a few other sort of background staff and stuff like that went out, took Maxim out. And I think he ended up, they got him drinking Mad Dog 2020, just making it as if it was like a local drink. And you want to have seen the state on the next morning. Read the game. You were playing Ross County the next day, and Maximo could hardly keep his eyes on. He was just like a burst ball, you know, it was just like almost hysteric.
Well, it was a heck of a run that Davey Hay got you going in, because the League Cup form was superb. He started off at Hampden against Queen's Park, dispatched them 3-1. I just realised that every game's away. Away to Dundee United at Tannadice in October, you won that. Away to Aberdeen in December in the quarterfinals, you won that one 3-2. And then away to Dundee at Dens Park in February, which set up the final in March against Hibernian at Hampden Park. How did the town of Livingston respond to having a team in the League Cup final? Because this is maybe the first new town that ever had a team that got that far. Traditionally, Livingston would have support from Glasgow or Edinburgh that moved there a generation ago. So what was it like in the town when Livy got to the final?
It was great. It was a great bit of PR for the club, and there was a lot of interaction between club and like local schools and stuff like that, getting a bit out and about in the community. You know, there was a lot of players turning up and just like doing little events, you know, like, you know, the appearances and stuff like that locally. Background, the actual commercial staff within Livingston as well. So yeah, we knew. I mean, Livingston itself, you know, there was a lot of fans of just Celtic, Aberdeen, Hart, Sibs, and all that kind of stuff. Fine. But we managed to drop there, and the home games were maybe 3,000 to 4,000 max, and that's you having a really good support. We managed to drum up 8,000 fans, so probably about half the population of Livingston gave me hand in. So it was a lot of kids. I mean, you think about it, actually, it was great because, you know, kids coming along, and there was a lot of kids running about the club. The club did a lot of really good stuff locally. You know, encouraging kids and all that, and so it was a massive, massive PR event, and to get 8,000 fans was, for us, was amazing, because they'd never brought that amount of fans together before. And you know, getting out on that final day at Hampden was amazing against Hibs. Hibs had sort of like 40,000 fans or something like that, but we looked at that little corner, the black and gold, and it was special. So the whole community bought in there. You know, and it's, to this day, it's the one and only cup final I've ever won, you know, major trophy. So special time, special day. And yeah, the town got right behind the team.
Well, the pedigree of some of the players in the team was amazing, because Dorada had been at PSG in Malaga. Rubio was in the books of Real Madrid. Fernandez was at Deportivo and Airdrie. So there was a lot of quality in that squad.
There was, and that, again, that was probably one of the reasons when I joined. And also, don't forget, during that season, administration, you know, so the day before we played the semi-final in the administration, we didn't have a big squad. I think there was maybe three or four players went, but the squad was a squad, and it was, you know, Stuart Lovell, Lee Mako, myself, David Fernandez, Jimmy McAllister, David Backman, me, Butler Bryan. Do you know what I'm saying? You look at it player for player and you think it was one of the best teams I'd ever played in. You know, that actually, I mean, being at Leeds with a good team, this was a team I was playing in every week. And it was littered with talent, good players, good pros, and a lot of ability. And it was no surprise to us we won the cup final, because we'd already beaten Hibs twice that season. And we'd been in a pretty good form. So it was and playing alongside David Fernandez was a season was for me brilliant. You know, my best ever strike partner from that perspective in terms of goals returning. Two completely different players. I mean, David is bonkers. Totally bonkers. Doesn't give a monkey's, you know. When David came in to train them on, he just looked, I think, falling out of his bed. He looked half sleepy. It was sort of like just if him do warm-ups for a shambles, like give him a ball at his feet. He was a wee bit like Charlie Mills at Maverick, you know. And the good thing for me was David was a track player, so I always had space. I just keep running in behind and keep running the ball. And David was exceptional in the final. And, you know, after a pretty shaky first half, you know, it was a quick two goals in the second half that put Hibs to the sword.
Well, we'll be remiss if we didn't bring up the one player that you didn't talk about there. And it's the one player that you notice from about a mile away because he's the size of three people. That's Marvin Andrews, the centre half.
Big love. What a guy.
How does somebody that had the really strict beliefs that Marvin have fit into a Scottish football dressing room?
See, well, Marvin's Marvin, and he's such positive energy. It's incredible. You know, you can't help but like the guy because everybody respected his beliefs and his religions. It's not something to try and impose on anybody. Everybody knew the score of him. Big man, you know, he was very much lived his life via now God, and that's what he believed in deeply. And, you know, who are we to criticise that? He couldn't hurt. He was such a nice guy, generous guy, funny guy as well. And just the big man would just laugh, constantly in a positive mood. And it just dropped off on everybody. And I think in that, Marvin had been there for a while, so it's not that the team, everybody, it was just Marvin. You know, any team he's ever been in, it's just the same effect on it. You know, he's the type of guy who tackles you in training. You know, he's totally flange in training. And he'll say, he just says, oh, sorry, I can pick you up. And you go, I mean, yeah, okay, Marvin, no problem. So, you know, you've never really seen Marvin getting booked. You know, everybody just liked him, you know. And there was no malice in anything Marvin ever done, you know. And you can see football players and, you know, you put them on a pitch and I'd be the same, you know, you can a switch goes a wee bit, you know, in terms of, when you can become a kind of different person, not Marvin. Marvin's just Marvin, you know, what you see me, Marvin's what you got. Every day, big smiles, big laugh, you know, he'd be making smoothies for boys and stuff, like bringing in big smoothies, all the stuff we drink, boys would be trying and it's infectious character.
Well, 5 minutes into the second half of the final, Burton O'Brien cuts the ball back in the left-hand side of the box. Striker's finish. Is that a moment that's going to live with you for the rest of your life?
It is. Yeah, absolutely. Alan Preston used to do training drills with me and other strikers. Where I scored from was literally the training drill that we had. He would stand on the byline and just cut the ball, just bang them just the front post there, 8-10 yards out. Left foot and right, he'd do some minor balls. We used to do that all the time in training. So it's quite funny when you think, looking back on it, that goal came about in the situation, and you think, I'd used to do that every day in training, you know, but it was just a natural reaction. But just, you know, hitting the back of the net, you know, live on television, and right at the corner where the fans were. I think when you see me, I look as if, I'm celebrating, but it's a bit kind of like, I'm a bit dazed or something like that. It's not as if I'm going bananas and I'm just kind of like, a bit delirious, you know, in terms of, it's a bit overwhelming when you see that ball hit the back of the net. And It's something that, yeah, it'll forever live with me, and it's a moment in history.
2 minutes later, and the entire squad were getting the tissues out because Jamie McAllister looked like he was about to have a nosebleed. That's one of those situations where everyone's screaming at him, going, what are you doing? And he only scored, I think he only scored one goal in Scottish football, and that was his one goal in Scottish football.
Well, it's so bizarre with the corner, and the corner came in the front post, and I think I hooked it out, and David Fernandez got on it. And he plays the ball through to Jamie, and honestly, now that the best view ever, I was literally standing, I'm running up towards the halfway line, and Jamie's right in front of me. I can see him running, and I'm, in my head, I'm going, oh, please score, or oh, stick it a wee dove, just what happened to it, oh, please score. And as soon as he, can you believe it? You know, because bang, bang, two goals, you know, and I had the great view of it. And it was, and what a finish for somebody who doesn't score goals. It was such a composed finish. And then, you know, we see the rest of the game out, and I can know there was a big centre half at Hibs called Colin Murdoch, big Irish guy, nice big guy. And we were about 10 minutes to go in the second half, and Hibs had Scott Brown and Thompson and Riordan and Tammy Barnes, so a really good young team. Big Colin turned out to me and says, we could be playing your right, you're just not going to score. It was one of these games you just knew, and that's the way they felt. And, you know, we hadn't really done that well in the first half. It's sort of maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes in the second half where we'd done okay. Banged in two goals and yeah, just saw the game out. And Marvin, Oscar, Manu at the back, you know, just defended Doug with all the end goals. And when that final whistle went, it was more relief than joy. You know, you're just like, it's like you've got over the line, you know, thank God for that.
Well, and when I spoke to Paul Mason a couple of weeks ago, he won the League Cup with Aberdeen, and he said it was business as usual, it was expected. But for Livingston, for the players there, it was a brand new feeling for the club, for a lot of the players who hadn't won anything. So what were the celebrations like afterwards? Because that definitely wasn't business as usual. This was something special.
No, I was. I mean, I think in the dressing room, it was, you know, everybody was so happy. You know, just we're happy for each other. You know, I think you're looking at a dressing room, maybe, you know, what you maybe call journeyman, you know, myself, Roddy, even Oscar, Manu, guys that have been about for a few years and, you know, done okay, but never really done anything to this year. The magnitude of winning a national trophy, you know, for a team like Livingston, knowing it's going to be, I remember, I think it was Billy Kirkwood, they say that's using the history books. Just little things like that, you know, in the dressing room, we're all elated. You're mentally shattered, you know, because of the whole kind of magnitude of the weekend. But can remember walking out of Hampden and Alan Preston's at the front of the bus with the trophy. And there was an off license just as you came out of Hampden. They pulled in the off license, the beer was coming on the bus and all that. And we're journeying back to Livingston, to Almondville, back into Livingston. We're also going along the NA Warway, there's loads and loads of Hibs fans, and we're all like waving cans of beer and all that, you know. So, and then we got back to Livingston, there was a bit of a, dude, there was a party, you know, but it wasn't a big party. We had a game, we were playing at Aberdeen, I think, the Tuesday or the Wednesday, in a cup game. We'd another game coming up, but we moved back to the ground and a few drinks. There was an open top bus tour, which was kind of quite low key, I suppose, but to be fair, fans came out, and you know, it was, when you think back to the day, it was such a special day, you know. But that journey back to Livingston was hysterical, and you just seen all the Hibs fans piling back.
Well, you seem to be a kind of cup specialist team, because that year you got to the semis of the Scottish Cup as well. You put Aberdeen out again in the quarters. I think it was Celtic that eventually got the better of you in the semi-finals, which shows it's kind of, it shows the togetherness and the fighting spirit in that squad.
Yeah, absolutely. We had, I think at one point, with the form that we had, you know, we'd obviously got the final for the CIS Cup, but they're running the Scottish Cup. And I think based on the form, we weren't that far away from getting top six, but I think the sort of season caught up with us a little bit towards the end. You know, we didn't have a big squad because I had the administration. You know, the majority of players were playing week in, week out. But we were, I think, and I think with the experience we had in the team, you know, we're good at cups. You know, we didn't panic. We could see games out. We could defend our score, defend our lead. I'd been playing well up front, was banging in goals, we were nicking games here and there. And, you know, And we were very much that season, done really, really well in the Cups. And unfortunately, I think Celtic beat us in the semi, two of, I think that's cold, honestly. We could beat 3-1, I think. But yeah, it was a great season. We were like, it's sort of second half of the season after administration, I think we really kicked on. And then I think as we get into sort of April, just after we played the final in March, I think April, May, the season just started to catch up as we ran out of steam.
Well, you ended up moving on from Livy in the 04-05 season, and it looked like you were going to go to Boston, but the decision was reversed. So you're going to have to come clean. Did you think you were signing for a team in the MLS and you didn't read the small print?
Oh, I know. What was I thinking? Yeah, Boston. I remember speaking to my agent at the time, and we had a few options, and the Hearts were in, Aberdeen were interested. There was a few other. I spoke to Aberdeen, and they offered us a deal, but it was okay. I was a wee bit disappointed. I thought, God, you know. And Boston were all, where is Boston? You know, where is it? Looking them up, Lincolnshire. Where's Lincolnshire? You know, looking them up, it's like. And I went down my agent, see that. And honestly, the stadium wasn't any better than Capital. And I was thinking, right, okay. You know, the money was really good. They were offering me good money. And I thought, right, okay, right. I'm 31. It's probably my last throw of the dice here. A good contract, 3 years. And I signed it. And then about 2 or 3 weeks later, it was Steve Evans, Scottish manager, I'd signed. And I'd spoke to my wife 2 or 3 weeks. And my wife had been down and we'd looked for houses. And we're at a rented house. We're sitting there and she's like, do you really want to play down here? And I'm like, nah, not really. And that's what happened. The next morning, my dad was down as well. And I says to my dad, I've got some news. He's like, I says, I'm no staying here. And I went back in and seen Steve Evans, tracked him down before we went to training. He was in like in a health club thing. And I says, look, Steve, I've made a mistake. I shouldn't have signed. Apologies. Don't waste your time. I've not been paid a penny. Don't want any money. I just need to get back up the road. This isn't going to work for me. Oh, you know, just stay and you can rent accommodation and you're waiting. I said, look, I'm not staying down here in my waiting Scotland. It's not happening. And ended up managed to get a deal to get back to Livingston. And then that was a story getting back to Livingston. But got back. I'm just desperate to get back on. Unfortunately, it was just the wrong way for me. I was making up a decision based on money, which was not the right decision. And back up the road.
So had Steve Evans had a chance to go through you at this point, because he's famous for waiting a couple of weeks, then he goes through a player in the dressing room?
I never even played a game for them. You know, we'd got it done and dusted. I think they realised how serious I was. It was one of those ones, I didn't want to say it, but look, if it's, I'll just go up the road, you know. And I think they'd phoned around a few clubs and ended up agreed something with Livingston. So there was never any, there was never any malice towards me. I never had the hairdryer. I'd seen him being quite mouthy with a few people. I think we'd had some bounce games and sort of pre-season games. And I'd seen him kicking off with a few people. But bizarre. Oh, the one thing I do remember is the standard of the team was okay. I can remember playing in a couple, and it was really weird because after I told them I was leaving, the players in the dressing room didn't know for maybe a week or so. But I trained that week. And you know, it was one of these weeks, I was doing things in training I don't think I'd ever done before. I was scoring goals from ridiculous angles and all that. And the boys are thinking, and I'm thinking, Christ, I'm actually doing really well here. And really weird. So it was all right with me. He was probably a bit pissed off that, you know, I decided to sign, but I think he understood. And I was just honest with him, say, look, you know, no point in sitting here trying to spin you a story. This is the truth, and I've made a mistake. So I avoided any sort of hairdryer treatment, which I know he is running for Alex. Likes to sound his own voice.
Well, you ended up moving back to Morton after another spell at Livy, then on to St Johnstone before joining Alan Moore at Stirling Albion. I've been on the end of an Alan Moore interview, which takes about an hour. How long did his team talks take?
Was, you know, they'd get promoted into the Championship, where it is now the First Division, and they were the only part-time team in the league, and I'd signed. And for me, I was at the end of my career. I mean, I was done, and I didn't feel there because I'd been full-time for the last 10 years, and I was part-time again. I just didn't feel fit. But me, Murray, was great guy, you know, really, really good guy, loves his ball. You know, he just said to me, as I'm doing just now, he could ramble on talking about that. Like, Gaffer, the game's kicking off in 5 minutes. You need to let this be.
I'm sitting down to talk to you. See, when you speak to Alan, when you're a journalist, you're holding your arm out. And it's like a form of Chinese stress torture because it's 15 minutes holding your arm out while he keeps talking. And you can't stop the interview because everything he says is fantastic. So you've got to keep him going. So it's hands all the time.
I would say probably one of the most enthusiastic managers I've ever came across in my life, and it was brilliant. I felt for a bit because I was at the end of my career, and if all honesty, you know, my mind was on other things. You know, I was trying to get, you know, make that transition from full time football back into normal life, so to speak. So yeah, but it was I never did myself justice. My head, my mindset wasn't right. It was just I was at the end of my career, and I'd sort of chucked the towel.
Well, your career ended at Forfar, and it ended with Dick Campbell as manager. So I think we'd be remiss if we don't get a Dick Campbell story.
Dick's brilliant. I mean, you're talking about wrestling, team talk with Alan Ware. Dick's brilliant. You don't know what he's coming out with. You know, sometimes Dick will give you a bit of poetry, or sometimes he'll give you a story. You know, his brother Pinker will get it. He'll be slotting his brother about stuff, you know, and just brilliant. I mean, Dick was just real. You know, he made things real, and I think he could always sense if somebody needed a kick up the arse and needed shouted at, he'd do it. You know, the big thing about before games is he wanted everybody to relax. You know, he doesn't want people get out there like all strung up. So there was always that fun element. But then he'd be serious, you know, like his brother Pink would be doing all the talks and the sort of formations and just tactics and all that. And Dick would be there He would very much make a quick transition from song, very jovial, but when it stopped the game time, he'd switch into game mode. And, I got to the end of that season again. I was 35 and I was done. You know, mentally, I wasn't ready to play on, and physically, I don't think I was either. And he says to me, look, why don't you come in, sign for another season, you know, just be on the sidelines type thing. And I went, look, I don't have it in me. I don't have the, you know, So they were great guys and they wanted me to stay on. And, you know, I met him a few months ago, I said, Dick, and he's just such a good character. Again, you know, to be in a dressing room, I can imagine what the approach players, that must have been a great experience for them, having Dick at the helm through that whole sort of, you know, period of trying to promote, because he'd have been saying the right things at the right times. You know, you've seen him with the media, it was brilliant, you know, but. And that's what Dick, it's just experience. And you know, when things are tough, you know, you'll lighten the mood a wee bit. But when things need a wee kick up the backside, he'll do that as well. But really, top guy.
All right, let's jump into our fast fire round. Let's get you thinking quickly. Who is the best opponent you've ever played against?
Jesus.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That is a name. I don't think I kicked the ball that day, but I was definitely on the pitch, and so was he.
Did he kick you?
He didn't need, he just took a ball off.
Who's the best teammate you've ever had?
Yeah, Alan Mahoud. Still my best mate.
Best goal you've ever scored?
Best goal would probably have got to be the Livy final goal, just for what it meant.
Best stadium you've ever played at?
One thing I did, it was something that I played at the old Arsenal, okay, one as a sub. And albeit it wasn't the best or the biggest, but it was iconic. You know, the old ground, so that definitely, I came on as a sub for a few minutes, but that felt really weird with the club on it, yeah. You know, the
best prank witnessed in the game.
Pritzy up at Dundee United, some of the stuff was hysterical. Boys get their cars moved down the corner. I'll tell you a really funny one, it happened a few times. Car's been parked, and there's a shower gel spray called Foam Bus, and it sprays a really fine line of gel, and boys used to spray it, see, but it was raining. Spray it on the wiper blades of some other people's cars. So seeing you started driving away when the blades came on, it just went all white. Oh, just all foamed up.
Don't try that at home. That's probably...
definitely not.
Best insult heard on a pitch, either from a player or from the crowd?
Do you know, I can't remember where it was. It'd been at Morton. And I don't know if it was Rowan or Ian, but there was a few experiences where there was a young player giving somebody stick, one of the players in their team stick. You know, you're done, you're finished, you're this, you're that, and all that. And And the guy turned around, and I'm sure he was at Morton, one of the guys, and he says, I know I'm finished. Do you know the reason I know that? Because I'm playing against you. And I thought, that was brilliant. You know, the boy didn't know what to say, you know what I mean? Just put him right in his spot.
And finally, what's the best crowd chant you've ever heard?
Do you know, I think it was one of the best ones. It's a song, but it's, see when you come out, Ellen Wood, and they're singing Marks and Owen together. It's pretty special. You know, when you came out, I always remember coming out that tunnel. It's a wee bit off centre, Brett, and you came out, and it's the big, you used to park out belt stand, the big double tier stand as you come out, and see when they're singing Marks and Owen together, that really gets you.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode. My thanks to Derek Lilly. If there's any estate agents listening, make sure you don't sell a house beside Charlie Miller. Join us next week for another forensic journey into the annals of Scottish football. Our website's at csi.com and you can find us on all the socials. So until next week, goodbye and thank you very much.
No, thanks very much for having me on here.